Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the OAES China Program podcast on the outlook for fossil fuels in China's energy transition and its geopolitical implications. My name is Anders Hovey. I'm Senior Research Fellow at the Institute, and I'm once again speaking with my colleague Michal Maidan, Director of the program, to discuss her paper that analyzes China's future demand for fossil fuels, the prospects for its oil and gas import needs, and the geopolitical implications of those trends. Michal, I'd like to first start by just discussing the overall role of fossil fuels in China's energy mix, and oil and gas in particular, and their impact on the economy. I know that the mix is quite a bit different from the way it is in, let's say, North America or Europe.
Absolutely. Fossil fuels account for roughly 83% of China's energy mix. That bit is not very different to the rest of the world. North America is roughly along those lines. Europe is closer to 75%. Within those fossil fuels, the breakdown differs quite considerably. China relies on oil for around 18% of its primary energy consumption and natural gas for under 10%. That compares to roughly a quarter of oil and gas each, and sometimes it's a third oil consumed in the energy mix by most OECD countries. So it's actually smaller than in many other countries, again, as a share of the energy mix. Having said that, China's overall energy demand has increased almost fourfold over the past two decades. And even though oil and gas are a relatively small share of that, the absolute volume has increased considerably. So today, China imports more oil than Saudi Arabia produces, for instance. And again, it imports. It is actually the second largest LNG importer globally, but on track to exceeding Japan as the biggest LNG importer. So even though it's relatively small, I guess, in China energy mix terms, it's really big for global markets and therefore has huge implications for global markets. Now, the reason that we're focusing a bit more on oil and gas than on coal, even though coal is very significant in China's energy mix, it's 56%, 5% of primary energy consumption, because there are fewer geopolitical implications of coal consumption, or at least direct implications. What do I mean by that? China has a lot of coal that it produces domestically, and therefore its import dependence for coal is roughly 10% of total consumption. It doesn't import that much coal, and therefore it's not a big strategic issue, unlike for oil and gas, where as China's demands have increased considerably, and even though it does have reserves of both oil and gas, it has needed to import much more from global markets, from producer countries, and therefore there are sort of geopolitical linkages here that come into play.
Just also on this economic impact of import dependence for oil and gas, for oil at least, unlike in North America and Europe, the, let's say, passenger vehicle demand for oil is not necessarily the predominant source of demand. So if there were some interruption due to geopolitical situation, there could be ways to prioritize so that consumers were not, or the regular daily life of the population was not affected as much.
Absolutely.
So with that background, could you talk to me a little bit about the purpose of the paper and the context for the paper? What were you trying to achieve?
The idea here was to, again, try and unpack the geopolitical implications of China's demand for oil and gas, I guess, looking forward at the energy transition. As like sort of China is the largest oil importer today globally, and as I said, set to become the second largest LNG importer. There have been many assumptions about what China has done in order to secure energy supplies, sort of the diplomatic and geopolitical implications of that dependency historically. And there's been considerable research and literature trying to unpack what has been commercially driven and what has been strategically driven. And so if you play that forward, what does China's energy transition look like? Should we assume that China's drive for electrification, which of course you've been looking at a lot, does that mean that it won't need any more fossil fuels and therefore it's not vulnerable or it's not exposed to any geopolitical risk? I think an added element that came into this paper is following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we're seeing, first of all, a certain fragmentation of global markets, and China sort of helping Russia sanction proof or avoiding sanctions and thinking about sanction proofing its own economy as its relations with the West deteriorate. So what does that look like, and how do we lay that into kind of geopolitical trends? Are we seeing axes of energy suppliers and producers coming together, again, for fear of US sanctions? And as we again look forward to the energy transition, if China no longer consumes oil and gas, and that's not the case, but as it relies on critical materials, can we learn any lessons from its oil and gas geopolitics? Will that help us understand how China will act and respond to producer countries of cobalt, lithium, nickel, other resources? So really the idea is to try and unpack energy demand, energy security, look at some of the future trends and start to pick apart what they mean. We do have some conclusions for this paper, but I have to say that in the process of writing it, we also came up with quite a few questions that we need to explore further.
In terms of import dependency, which is, I think, the phrase that we often hear Chinese policymakers mentioning, why is import dependency for oil and gas a geopolitical issue for China specifically?
It's been interesting since China became a net importer of oil in the mid-1990s. As I said, China's a producer of oil. It currently has 4 million barrels a day. That's kind of roughly Iraqi production levels. So it's not a small producer of oil, but its total consumption is 14 million barrels a day. So that import gap is really big, and China relies for 75% of total supplies on imports. So over the course of these of its sort of import dependency, it has thought about the various vulnerabilities that this exposes it to, and they relate to gas as well, but it started, of course, with oil. Its concerns about outages in producer countries and what happens to China's oil supplies, the economic implications of higher oil prices, and again, what they mean for the Chinese economy at 14 million barrels a day. If you're paying $60 per barrel or $100 per barrel, that has a huge impact on the economic toll. There are questions around what if the US or other countries try and block off supplies to China, what happens to sea lanes of communication, sort of to maritime flows. And so there have been efforts in China to think through various responses, again, diversify supply sources, have a footprint in global upstream, so try and produce the oil. And there have been a lot of speculation about whether this is a government ploy to try and control oil, or actually it's been a corporate effort to internationalize China's oil and gas companies. And the answer is probably a bit of both. But we've seen China invest more in overseas upstream globally. We've seen it try to nationalize trading, shipping, again, some of it in response to sanctions. So really think about the entire supply chain, also thinking about demand-side management and demand-side measures. Electrification of the fleet is one very typical example where by switching to electric vehicles, you ultimately reduce your demand for oil for transport and therefore limit some of that dependency on imported oil. But for now, China for oil still requires roughly 75% of imports. For gas, it imports 44% of total supplies, so are less vulnerable to outages, but increasingly so. And the energy security then dimension comes as well for producers. So with China being the largest consumer, they need to ensure their demand market. So they need to make sure that they have who to supply to. And there's a competition today between sanctioned crudes like Iranian, Venezuelan, and Russian crudes and other crudes, for instance. And then there are questions for other consumers. So if China is the biggest consumer, will producers want to, you know, prioritize China in the event of sanctions or a war? What does China's demand mean for prices? You know, there are a lot of different, there's kind of the strategic geopolitical about not being able to fuel the military machine, for instance, if there was a supply outage. But then there are lots of other concerns, economic and others, around import dependence.
So how does this change over time? We know that China has goals to achieve carbon peaking by 2030 and carbon neutrality by 2060. How do different researchers and you see the energy transition affecting China's import dependence for oil and gas and the trajectory for that overall oil and gas demand?
So I have to say that there are lots of analyses and lots of scenarios that are being worked on to date and constantly. And this is, I think, part of the uncertainties, the research that we will be doing more of, you know, what China's energy transition could look like. To simplify for this paper, we've tried to base the forecast mainly on existing scenarios, IEA, various scenarios, CNPC, the Chinese institutions, also the Tsinghua ICCSD, so one of the kind of first to come out, I think it was the first to come out with China, a sort of a feasibility scenario for China's net zero. So we've based on those. And as you can imagine, there are very different outlooks for China's oil demand. So some have it peaking in 2040 at sort of current levels. Some have it peaking, I think most have it peaking in 2040, but it's between current levels or 10 million barrels a day. So quite a sharp drop. And then the question is, how quickly does it fall thereafter? Does it plateau and only gradually decline, or does it drop off to 4 million barrels a day by sort of 2050, 2060? So big convergence in views, again, depends on EV penetration and other factors. But I think what is consistent in all of these scenarios is that whichever way you look at it, China remains the largest oil consumer and importer throughout the period to 2050. There's a similar question sort of for gas. Again, there's different views on whether China's gas demand peaks in 2035 or 2040 at around 550 BCM. It consumes today 370 BCM, or whether that's at, again, 2040 at around 650 BCM. So how much does it grow? And then how quickly does it fall off? Different views on that. But again, China remains one of the biggest, or the biggest, gas consumer and importer throughout the period. So even though volumes matter and how much China is going to import matters, the fact remains that China is still significantly exposed to global markets, and global markets are hugely exposed to the variations in China's demand.
How does the outlook for supply change as a result of China's various possibilities for its demand evolving over this long time frame?
So the supply picture changes in part according to China, or sort of, and this is obviously the chicken and egg type of issues that, you know, do suppliers and do producers invest in more oil and gas with the uncertainty around demand? Again, that's China, but also India and other emerging economies that will be the biggest consumers of oil and gas going forward. But it's also related to other countries, to supplier countries' net zero pledges, both for their internal consumption, for their operations. Again, different scenarios here, but I think the common thread is that there will be fewer suppliers, a smaller list of suppliers, but we will see the same sort of names and countries being the biggest exporters and therefore the biggest source of supply to China. And those are heavily concentrated in the Middle East. We're looking at the Gulf countries for oil, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Qatar for gas. And Russia and the US both loom very large, both in oil and gas, in the supplies to China. So essentially, we've got a smaller pool of both consumers and suppliers that are more tightly integrated together in this sort of energy transition world.
Speaking of those tight relationships, there's a lot of Middle Eastern oil that's heading towards China. Is that what has driven China's desire to play a more active role in the Middle East?
That's sort of been the million-dollar question for anybody looking at China-Middle East relations, I would say for the past, well, 20, even 30 years. It has been that question of, when will China have to get its sort of hands dirty in the Middle East and get more involved in Middle Eastern geopolitics? Because at some point, it won't be able to sit on the fence and be neutral in UN decisions. Presumably, at some point, it's going to have to step in defense of its energy interests, or at least to proactively manage its energy interests. And I think up until very recently, until China mediated between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and that was just a couple of months ago, that kind of brokered that peace deal between the two, it had managed to stay very much on the sidelines of a lot of geopolitical events. And to be fair, I don't think that the Saudi-Iran mediation is necessarily a big move forward. Symbolically, it's huge, right? Because China did take a sort of a diplomatic view and tried to coordinate between two fighting states. But I think the door was already quite open to that negotiation. There was a lot that was happening at the back end of Iran and Saudi Arabia trying to come together. And it was a relatively easy deal to seal sort of diplomatically. Now, I think what's perhaps more not necessarily more important, but we have to consider is that China's relations with the Middle East have been built on oil. That was sort of the primary driver for deeper relations. China did have a history of relations in the Middle East. It was a big exporter of weapons. It was a big exporter of construction companies. And so it built on those ties when it started requiring more oil. And it has tried throughout the years to even out the trade deficit for its oil imports. So it's tried to export more goods to the Middle East and to develop ties that go beyond energy so that it's not a one-way system. And today, you know, China does have quite a big footprint in many countries in the Middle East, not just with its oil importers, that again are sort of Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, the UAE, Kuwait, but it also has very strong economic ties with Israel and pretty much with every country in the region. So it has really diversified its relations. Now, you could argue that because it has a bigger economic footprint in the region, it would want to take a more active role in shaping the sort of security or the security situation. But you could flip that argument and say, actually, because it is working with so many conflicting states, right? Iran, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, sort of the whole picture is complicated, then it serves China's interest to keep the geopolitical issues at arm's length to the extent that he can. I think there's also, from producer countries' point of view, a desire to hedge. They realize that China brings a lot of benefits, but the US is still the security guarantor of the region. And I think closer relations with China are a good leverage in order to gain more concessions or to gain attention, I guess, from the US. And we can't forget that a lot of the economies are still dollar denominated or sort of hugely exposed to the US dollar. And therefore, even though China is becoming clearly more important and will be an important export market going forward, I think there's still a desire on both sides to keep other actors involved and to make sure that the relationship is broad and extends beyond energy.
So it's not a switch from the US or the West to China, but rather diversification. What about gas? What's the outlook for China's gas demand, first of all?
So again, we sort of said that gas demand could peak at another 200 BCM or another 300 BCM. Again, those are really big numbers for global markets. But there is, and obviously, a huge amount of uncertainty around gas consumption. We've been talking about that also in other podcasts, with not just with renewable penetration, but actually with the government wanting to use coal as backup and making sure that coal is the backbone of the energy system and remains the backbone of the energy system. I think that's the geopolitical angle of coal, not the import dependency for coal, but coal as a flexibility and as a flexibility mechanism, which actually helps China, not in its environmental quest, not in its emissions reductions, but actually for energy security, coal is hugely valuable. And so gas depends both on coal and renewables, but actually diversification in gas is much harder. When we talked about oil, I mentioned a very small number of countries. I mean, today China imports oil from roughly 40 countries, even though there's a handful of the top five account for sort of over half of that flows, and they're very much concentrated in the Middle East. With gas, the markets are not as developed. They're not as fungible as with oil. But again, China relies on a smaller number of suppliers. There are pipeline flows, and sort of the mix between pipeline and LNG is not 50-50. There's more LNG than pipelines, but with more pipeline flows from Russia, China, I think, has been trying to keep seaborne flows and land-based flows roughly equivalent. So, you know, its pipeline flows come from Central Asia, and its LNG comes from Australia, Indonesia, Malaysia, so a lot of Asian countries, as well as Qatar and increasingly the US. Now, if you fast forward that to the suppliers that will be around in the energy transition, you're actually left with a relatively small number of countries. Again, the Central Asian countries, Russia looms very large, Qatar in the Middle East, and then from the LNG suppliers, in addition to Qatar, the US and Australia. So it's quite a tricky picture from a geopolitical perspective, and achieving that diversification is much harder than for oil.
And as well, the government has seemingly on the policy front, especially since the Russian invasion, looked to potentially tamp down on the growth of gas demand in various sectors, including for residential heating. I wonder if you could just talk about what China's approach has been in the past 15 months following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, how sanctions have impacted energy markets in China, how does that impact China's thinking about energy security overall, as well as oil and gas specifically?
It's a very good question. And again, oil and gas differ quite considerably, I think, because China's dependence on oil is so developed and so heavy already, it has less levers to pull on the sort of restricting demand like it has with gas. With gas, there's sort of a lot of areas where, as you just mentioned, policy can dictate the speed and pace of additional demand growth. But what the government has really been talking about a lot, a number of things. First of all, the role of coal that we just touched on, and that has made a massive comeback in the discourse, not just because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but because of increasing tensions with the US, and this is something that goes back to 2019. So certainly thinking for gas about ways to potentially reduce consumption. I wouldn't go as far as to say that China will not grow its gas demand because of geopolitical concerns. You know, we've talked about concerns about the US, about sanctions. But despite that, China has signed quite a large number of LNG supply contracts with the US over the past 2 years. So there's sort of commercial drivers and there are strategic drivers, and sometimes they clash, but sometimes they don't. But I think that there has been quite a lot of thinking about sanction-proofing the economy. Again, I think oil consumption, oil dependence is too far gone, but stockpiling, hedging, nationalizing supply chains even further. Again, this is something that China has done. It has an army of traders and a shipping fleet and insurance companies. It is advancing RMB trade, even though I think there's a bit too much hype about sort of the petro yuan, about kind of the RMB displacing the US dollar in international commodity trade. There's clearly more trade that's happening in RMB because sanctioned countries want to trade in a currency other than US dollar. So I think there are interesting developments in sanction-proofing the economy on one hand, sort of on the supply side, and then trying to work on demand, especially for gas. I don't think we're seeing enough sort of energy efficiency push. The electrification drive, I think you're better placed than I am to talk about whether or not that's accelerated because of oil dependency. My gut sense is that it's accelerating because of technological advances, because of the availability of models, because of consumer appeal, rather than an energy security specific focus.
So, Mikhail, you've raised a lot of issues, and we know that there's a lot more in your paper, but are there any other things that we've left out that you should mention before we close things off for today?
I think there's one important point to make here is that oil and gas does not live in isolation to other things. What do I mean by that? Is that energy is closely linked to other interests, to geopolitical diplomatic interests, and to China's ties to the world. Using less oil and gas does not mean that China is independent from global oil and gas markets. Even though the volumes could drop and the strategic significance or the strategic impact of an oil and gas outage could be lessened or could be reduced in terms of its impact for the Chinese economy, perceptions matter. So the way China perceives its vulnerabilities is just as important as the actual vulnerabilities. I would argue that today for China, for oil, China is not hugely vulnerable to a supply outage. If there was a shock, a short-lived shock, China has enough reserves that actually the economy would not be crippled. Yes, there would be an impact, but it would not be crippling for the Chinese economy. But the sense of vulnerability is still very much present. Equally, the energy transition does not make China self-sufficient. Even though China is going to produce a lot of renewables and it has a lot of coal and it could do nuclear, it is still dependent on the world for critical materials, for other inputs. Even if there is a de-risking or decoupling from the West, there are still considerable ties, be they shipping flows, be they sort of what happens to producer countries of whatever resources and materials. China is still deeply connected to the world. And so China's views of the geopolitics of energy will depend on domestic policies, security, foreign policies, economic policies, how it sees its role in the world, and of course, most significant, I think, is how it sees its ties with the US and with the West. Now, I know that that opens a huge can of worms in addition to oil and gas, but I think it is important that sort of just as we look at different bits of the energy sector, we also try and keep in mind that this is a broader and more holistic question that has to be taken into account. And again, things that we will continue to research into, both the details of various demand side or supply side questions, and also trying to, I think, unpack that bigger picture perspective.
You definitely made the point very clearly that there are a lot of moving parts, a lot of interdependencies, both globally and then in terms of the domestic policy and energy mix. And for me, I think the big takeaway is that even as the world's largest importer of oil and gas, and then also seeing oil and gas imports potentially growing strongly, that doesn't mean that the analogy to, let's say, the West in the 1970s is in any way applicable to the Chinese situation today. So a lot more to look at, and of course, a lot more in your paper, which, as usual, you'll be able to find that paper on the OIES website. Michal, thank you again. Listeners, we hope you've found this discussion useful, and we'd certainly welcome any feedback. And we hope you join us again next time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.